Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Ian King as my special expert guest. Ian King began his coaching career in 1980 with the aim to answer the question, what is the best way to train and to provide athletes with the solutions he found? By 1986, with over 100 elite athletes under his guidance, he founded King Sports International. King Sports International trains coaches and athletes worldwide. KSI, which is the acronym for King Sports International, distributes numerous DVDs, ebooks, and e-videos dedicated to health and fitness education, and also operates training centers for athletes in a number of locations throughout the world. Ian wrote and taught the first strength training accreditation course in Australia and was the primary contributor for the first strength and conditioning accreditation courses offered in Australia. His popular guidebook to getting bigger, stronger, and leaner is called Get Buffed and is also available as a 12-unit course delivered by text, audio, and video. Good morning, Ian, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning, Corey, and thank you for inviting me.
It's our pleasure. And by the way, it's in the afternoon here and it's the morning there. So tell us where you are and maybe give us a bit of a background, telling us maybe some insight about where you were born and where you were raised.
So right now I'm in the third country I've been in the last 3 weeks. I'm currently in Australia. As far as my country of origin, I was born in the islands of the Pacific, in a little island off the far top right-hand corner of Papua New Guinea called New Britain, in the little town of Rabaul. I was raised in Papua New Guinea, which was an excellent breeding ground for anyone who had an interest in sport.
So tell us about your experience growing up as a child. Were you attracted to sport? Did you play sports? And then how did that lead into the weight training?
The interesting thing for anyone who's been exposed to the island culture is that, at least in pre-information or pre-TV days, islanders just played. So they played all day long, and that's exactly what we did. I'm not suggesting I lived in a village, but we just played from the moment we got up to the moment we went to bed, and that play would involve a sporting implement of some kind. And if you drive through any of the villages or even down the road through Fiji or any other of the islands in the Pacific, for example, you'll still see evidence of that. So play for me was I defined as sport. So we played sport, but I defined it as we played. And it certainly gave me a special ability to work with islanders because we understand that sport should be play and that play should be fun. So my interest was obviously peaked with play or sport. I had some unique experiences along the way, which maybe were more than coincidental.
So you originally set out with the aim to discover the best way to train, and your history and your confession, your presentation, I've watched several of your YouTubes, very, very similar to my own, going into the environment and feeling as if everybody's doing something wrong, and yet there's got to be a great way, a right way to do this. So tell us what you discovered, Ian.
So I started, obviously, playing as a child, but I got introduced to weight training also at about the age of 7, which was pretty unique in Papua New Guinea at that time. But I came upon, and again, I'm not sure that it was coincidence, I came upon the local strongman, and he couldn't speak, he couldn't hear, so we communicated with sign language and did his best to communicate. And he had this strong interest in strength training, so he exposed me to strength training at the time. And as I got more involved in sport throughout my younger years, it became apparent to me that I wasn't sure whether the people who were guiding me knew what they were doing, which is not a criticism. I just felt that there was something missing and I wanted to know the answers. So I had the opportunity to go to boarding school in Australia for high school, and I was sure that I was going to find the answers. Now, this is fairly unique for a child wanting to know how to train because, I'd be involved in organized sport, as you call it, and I'd be involved in strength training in a personal sense. So I went to Australia with this grand expectation that Australians would know what they were doing. And again, with no disrespect, where I ended up was in the training facility at the high school I went to in Australia was a World War II demountable. There was holes in the floor, the barbells were rusted bars, just old steel bars where the ends had been put into concrete jam tins. And that was basically the weight training equipment. And I thought this was fantastic. I'd never seen anything as good as this before. But as I progressed through high school, it became again apparent to me and to the credit of the phys ed teachers, they didn't know what they were doing. So we would do things like run around the golf course with bricks in our hand and we'd do our best, but I knew there was something missing. So I then went on to university for the sole purpose of answering the question, what's the best way to train? This is just a question that bugged me throughout life. And again, it came pretty apparent to me that, again, with no disrespect to my teachers at university, they really had no idea. So I set out on a personal journey to discover the answers. And I set out that, you know, concurrently in 1980, both doing coaching as well as seeking the answers. And during the next 15 to 18 years, I was really happy with some of the conclusions I reached. I've been able to test them in the real sense with high volume of numbers of athletes in multiple sports. And I began teaching fairly openly a lot of things that I'd concluded by the late 1990s. But it had literally been a near two-decade professional study, let alone a lifelong pursuit.
Ian, can you give us an example of something that high numbers of people worldwide in training do wrong that you think needs to be corrected, and where you've made the correction and there's been a phenomenal transformation or value in terms of performance and health?
And I'm going to give you a really good one. I think it's very pertinent to today's society in both the sport and non-athletes. I wanted to understand why bodybuilders had a certain shape during the 80s, and I didn't like their shape. And I thought there had to be a way to avoid this. Plus, I wanted to avoid any shoulder injuries. After I saw my first athlete with a shoulder reconstruction and had to help them rehabilitate, I said, this is not going to happen again. I'm never going to see another athlete in this condition. So I set about seeking to understand how to design, for example, strength training programs to avoid muscle imbalances throughout the body, both from a visual as well as from an injury prevention and a performance perspective. And after many years, in excess of 10 years of deliberation, I firmed up on a concept that I called the lines of movement concept. Well, the only word that was in existence at the time was quad dominance. The physios during the 80s were using the word quad dominance. So I came up with the word quad dominant and then hip dominant to balance it out. And then I went to the upper body, and there was a concept of pushing and pulling in place. People talked about it, no one actually did it. So I clarified it to say you've got vertical pushing and pulling and horizontal pushing and pulling. So that was the core. There were the core six categories in my lines of movement concept. And I published that for the first time in 1998. It didn't take long before people were publishing it in the absence of any sort of referencing and credit, which, you know, is their choice. But what I believe, it denied the people reading it to connect with the origin and the intent, because I had a very clear intent of what I was doing. So despite the fact that that concept is now fairly commonly known, shall we say, I don't believe it's truly understood. And what we see now is a continuation of the same problems that occurred. For example, in the 1980s, if you read any bodybuilding book, including the classics, what they call the back was the back. They didn't define the back in a vertical pull, which is chins and lats, pull downs and rows as the horizontal pull, as in two separate lines of movement. It was just the back. So the same misunderstanding of the body that existed in the 80s before I released this concept in the 90s is still there, because even though the concept is published by many without reference, there is just no understanding of it. What we're seeing is as new trends and exercises come along, people are still making the same mistake. And I'm going to give you the number one example. Now, I've traveled around the world more times than I can remember. And there are two dominant muscle imbalances in strength training universally are imbalances through dominating in the bench press or the vertical, the horizontal pushing, and dominance through the squats or in quad dominance. So what I'm seeing now, if I go down and take a drive in the morning or look at people out in the park doing their little boot camps, working with their personal trainer, the number one muscle imbalance that's affecting the average person in the market, the average training to get healthy, is a imbalance in the quad and hips. And I'm going to give this example. If an exercise becomes popular, such as, say, the walking lunge or variations of that, it doesn't mean that you should be doing it. And what we're seeing is a worse scenario now than I did. I saw back in the 80s, I saw an imbalance in the quads and hips, which I sought to rectify. But now I'm seeing that imbalance throughout the entire population. And there are trends in training that are really reinforcing that. And what I want to stress is this. People are becoming very health conscious, and they're eating well, but they're going out and doing terrible things to their body. And I don't say that from a judgmental point of view. I don't need to be right or wrong. I'm just sharing, I've been at this for 30 plus years. It's very clear. Everything I've concluded has ultimately been or will be confirmed by science and by research. And I'm making a very clear statement that the world is suffering from the exposure to excessive quad exercises. And I liken quad exercises to sugar. And I liken this relationship to the sugar impact in the diabetic epidemic. Because if you want to smash someone and feel like they've had a big workout, give them a lot of muscle soreness, you know, the quads is a great way to do it, obviously. So people are doing this because they're getting this fix. But this fix is not healthy, and it is causing the same level of damage to the body from a musculoskeletal perspective as sugar is doing to diabetes in the health of people. So this is a strong parallel that I want to make, and I am very concerned that the understanding of physical training is so far behind the understanding of health. Now, I note that Weston Price's work took over 100 years to take real impact before it hit a tipping point. So perhaps in 100 years, what I'm teaching will be reach a tipping point. But if you're listening to this and if you're being exposed to my teachings, you can be saved a lot of grief if you understand the need to balance and how to balance the body in exercise. So that's an example for you, Corin.
That's an excellent example, and that's something that we can all understand. And, of course, we, CHI, we have as one of our partners the Price Foundation, and I love the work, and it stood the test of time, now is coming out to the masses more so than ever. But you're right, there's a big focus on health without the connection to how you move the body. And every time I walk into a gym or visit a gym when I'm traveling around, you see the same old movements done incorrectly, and of course the same kinds of injuries. Now, you're a mentor to a lot of athletes and a teacher, but who is your mentor or teacher, or do you even have any?
Yeah, I've had many along the way, but what I've done differently, and I'm differently to perhaps anyone else in my industry, not necessarily differently to others in other industries, is that when I was into my second decade, I decided that I needed to expand my studies. And in the early 90s, I became a student of business, finance, personal development, etc., which was very unique in my industry because it's focused on sets and reps and the variables of training, etc. And as a result, I believe that they don't live a fulfilled life. And I can come to the conclusion that there was more to life than sets and reps, and that there was more to life than, you know, being tied to work per se, or identifying yourself as a person that you work as, or being really struggling financially if you couldn't work on any given day. And that sums up the physical preparation industry. So throughout the 90s, I expanded my studies right through down to futurism. You know, I really broadened my studies, spirituality. So I have many mentors from the Dalai Lama down in terms of who I choose to study from. Some of the greats that I've been influenced by, so for example, in personal development, Jim Rohn. In spirituality, I'm a big fan of Taoism and the writers in that regard, and there's some particular writers that I lean to there. But coming back to, as far as financial education, I think Robert Kiyosaki's done a phenomenal job for the world. Coming back to physical preparation, I've had many influences, but also I've been a bit unique in that I've gone outside. And when I say gone outside, the Americans, and I raised this question many years ago, have a reluctance or had a reluctance during the 80s and 90s to seek or reference people outside their own country, and I couldn't quite understand that. So I've enjoyed a learning from a number of people, in particular in the Eastern Bloc, or the former Eastern Bloc, in the former Eastern Germany. There were periods of time in my lifetime where some really great work was done, and I understand that some of that work was implemented under the conditions of sports performance drugs, but if we can take that out of the equation and reduce the volumes to take that into account. So I've had a real diversity in mentorship, but I describe it as holism, and we present from a holistic perspective.
Excellent. Yeah. I believe I coined the term holistic sports nutrition. Of course, do you know Michael Colgan? Have you met him? Have you read any of his books?
Yeah, I became exposed to Michael in the early 90s or the late 80s. Michael's a former New Zealander, as I understand it, and I've been watching him, you know, right throughout.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems as if all the great people seem to have a connection to other great people, and it's a continuous chain. Now, if you ask 100 athletes or spectators what the purpose of sport is, unanimously, almost 100% will say the purpose of sport is to win. Do you agree with that position? And if not, why? And if so, why?
I've got some pretty unique positions on that, so I'll share that with you. Obviously, I grew up in play, and I believe sport is play. And when it loses a play element, it becomes soulless. And I talked to a lot of, so for example, different Division I athletes in America who are on scholarship. They don't enjoy what they're doing. It's lost its soul. For me, I believe society uses sport as a means of distracting the people. And I date it back to the Greek and Roman times, where the rulers would throw people into the Colosseum with a lion and have them eaten, or a few gladiators killing each other. And I guess it's not cynical, but for me it's realistic that the purpose of sport is entertainment, or to take it the next step further, is to distract the masses. And therefore, the intent that sport is used for, and my belief for what sport should be, which is play, are two different things. And I do my best to align what I teach the athletes that I work with, and they enjoy what we do, etc. But at the end of the day, I can't change the world, and I can't control how sport. So in my opinion, sport is manipulated. I'm very guarded that people should be caught up just watching sport all day long on TV or etc. But you know, so as far as some of the trends in sport, well, we can talk about that. But my position is that sport is either entertainment or distraction for the masses.
Here, here, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Now, can I ask you what your favorite sport is and why?
I typically don't talk favoritism because my history is working with so many athletes that if they sense any degree of favoritism, it's like working with your children. You know, if you go and pat one child on the head, the other three say, what's wrong with me? So I really don't talk. My attitude is if you are attracted to that sport, if you are passionate about that sport, if you are driven to fulfill your potential and meet your needs in that sport, go for it. You know, that could be anything. And I'm pretty open with athletes. I was working with helping skiers become Olympic medalists before I even put a pair of skis on. I don't claim to be all sports. You know, I have some influences, but for me, it's really, you've got to be passionate about it. At the end of the day, find something that you're passionate about enough to do lifelong, or in the case of elite sport, find something that you're passionate enough to drive to being the greatest you can be. And that's my guideline to people.
What about violence in sport? We see this everywhere today. Football, rugby, lacrosse, hockey, UFC, that takes the cake, I think. Personally, you know, I'm a naturopath. I'm committed to a do no harm principle. But I did play lacrosse, I did play football, I did play hockey, and a lot of these sports are rough. And actually, it was the violence in the sport that drove me out of them. So do you measure society like Aristotle by the degree of violence in the sport? You talked about sport being used. Do you think that that's part of what's going on, the violence in the sport?
I have been absolutely stunned at the direction sport's taken over the last decade. And again, no disrespect to the fighting sports, but you know, you've mentioned UFC, etc. I've been stunned by the rise in popularity of blood sports. And I think that is very indicative of the social and economic climate we find ourselves in. And I don't want to necessarily open that Pandora's box unless it's specifically requested to. But I think there are reasons why we're heading in that direction. My attitude is this. If you go to play sport and your intention is to maim, I hope you're in the right sport. So, for example, if you're playing a team sport where you've got a ball, a puck, a stick or something, and you go out with the intent to maim, I think you should be banned for life. Now, I understand the impact occurs, etc. Now, if you play a blood sport, different ball game, that's your choice. So I do not condone the intent to maim in sports where violence is not the intent, but I respect that in a contact sport, in a fighting sport, the intent is obviously more specific to that. And I do work with a lot of fighting sport athletes, and I think there's nobility in being a warrior, but I don't think there's any nobility in being an aggressor for the intent of maiming someone in a sport that's not a blood sport per se. And I think there's a message for all of us in the direction that the sport has taken. You know, it comes back to what I talked about in terms of, you know, if the problem is greater in society, then we need to provide a more gripping visual to distract people from the realities of the world. But no, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, good comment. Now, it seems as if a lot of what you've got available to purchase on your site revolves or is centered around your book, Get Buffed. So maybe you could give us some insight about that and some of its content and maybe what some of the central messages of the book are.
So just to clarify that, it's probably what you can see, and it's probably popular from a mass perspective. For me, the Get Buff product was a byproduct of what I do. So we set out to train athletes, educate coaches, and as a result of training athletes, we realized we developed some amazing bodybuilding-type methods that were far superior to what everyone was doing. And we were encouraged to share that in the late 90s in a number of internet publications, etc., and hard copy publications that I wrote for, and in like Teen Nation and Men's Health, Men's Fitness, etc. And as a result of that, we grew the Get Buff range. So the Get Buff range is aimed at people who are drug-free and want to train for internal reasons. So the purpose of training is to have better function in life, to have better quality in life, and they don't mind the outcome, which is they get a good-looking body. But I'm certainly a little bit embarrassed, you know, by the image. We've got the image on the bicep on the front. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek. And I'm not a fan of picking up, say, you know, the Men's Health magazine and you see some low body fat person on the front. It gives the wrong impression. So that's not the message I want to send. We don't market our athlete trainings on the internet because we only work with referrals. And our coach education is something that we allow people to be drawn to us rather than heavily promote it. So I guess the only thing you do see to any great extent is the Get Buff Range. If you want a quality of life, if you want to avoid muscle imbalances, if you want to do stuff that, you know, admittedly is not everyone else is doing, and like I recommend things like stretching. I know that's currently politically incorrect, et cetera, et cetera, but that's a story in itself. So if you want a quality training program that will give you a long history of training in the future and give you quality of life, I can highly recommend the Get Buff Range. In fact, the principles that I place in the Get Buff Range are the same principles, obviously, I've taken from the athletic field. And I would suggest that more people around the world in the gym are using my concepts that you'll find in the Get Buff Range than any other single source of training mythology. And I know that might sound a bit extreme, but if you understand the level of copying that's occurred with my works, and if you trace it back to the source, you'll understand why I make that statement. So I'm very confident that the Get Buff Range will serve everybody.
Would it be fair to say that your primary focus and emphasis and work is on training methodology and exercise strategy? That's your major emphasis, as opposed to nutrition, which would be my major emphasis. And of course, I'm sure, obviously, you must have studied, you must understand the significance of nutrition. And obviously, it's the same for me, too. Nutrition's the central focus, but training, exercise, technique, strategy, all of that is completely essential as well. So where do you stand on the importance of nutrition, and how much time and energy do you put in that with your athletes and coaches?
A great question. So when I came in, I came into the industry when there was a big hole in how to train, and I filled that hole to a large extent. And then over time, I identified there were other limitations, and one of them being nutrition. You see, in the 1980s, when I'm working with elite athletes, the advice that they were getting from, inverted commas, the qualified nutritionists, and again, I want to be respectful, so I'll pick my words carefully, it was inadequate, and I'll put that as politely as I can. So what I found myself doing was researching nutrition to a greater extent for the sole purpose of helping the athlete fulfill their potential. So I never set out to be a nutrition expert. I'm not suggesting I am, but I've definitely had to do a lot of work to cover up the inadequacies of that service, the nutritional service that I believe has been provided throughout the decades. And we can talk about where it is from a contemporary perspective, but going back historically. So I've been very much influenced, as I've commented before, by the Western price, because, and we'll talk about trends and the influence of money, commercialism on trends and research, etc. But at the end of the day, there is a lack of awareness or focus on the basics. And the basics for me, including, listen, where was your food produced? How was it produced? How long has it been since it was killed? What's happened to it since? And has it been exposed to the sun, etc.? So there's a lot of simple stuff that I do. And from a supplemental perspective, you know, people are off being very esoteric and looking for the latest commercially influenced trend. You know, the concept that Linus Pauling presented so many years ago about the importance of vitamins and now what we call antioxidants is in the cellular protection of the body, that's an area that, again, is completely underdone and misunderstood in the pursuit of, in the pursuit of commercial profit and the power of the trend.
Yeah, well, you certainly brought up a name that I'm familiar with. Of course, I met and mentored through Linus Pauling. He introduced me to Abram Hoffer, who I apprenticeshipped with on Victoria Island, and that brought me to orthomolecular, you know, biochemistry and a lot of the principles that relate to health and wellness. And then I tried to tie that in with the athletic model, but I found that growing up as an athlete, Ian, very few athletes cared at all about nutrition. They were just happy to eat McDonald's and eat fast food. And still, that's not the exception, that's the rule. So how is it that you invoke change, or what is your approach with people regarding what they eat? Because it's almost like a religious experience. When you challenge anybody who's eating a certain way, it's bringing them back to the very seat of their family experience and what their mother said, and there's a lot of tradition. So one of the ways I find that you can find out about a person is just to simply ask them what they eat. So what do you eat, and what do you think is a good way for you to eat on a regular basis?
So coming back to one point before you made that about the emotional connection to food and the family habits, and that is so powerful. For me, let's say that there's 100 ways an athlete could get better, and there's more than that. My attitude is, if we're progressing, that's fantastic, and let's be as good as you want to be. In other words, if an athlete is not committed in that area, then that's their choice. At the level I work with, at the lead end, I basically pre-select people on the level of commitment. So for me, we seek excellence in every department. But I understand what you're saying in terms of the majority of the masses, and I don't hold the athlete totally responsible for that, because there's been some pretty mixed messages coming out of, in particular, the nutritional field. I mean, when we were through the 80s, they were told that they didn't eat any more protein than the average person, that vitamins were a waste of time. Some of the traditions and the dogma, and these things stick. These things don't go away quickly. So I actually have a large degree of sympathy or empathy for the athlete's position, because, in all fairness, they have not been served up with the greatest guidance. For me, I've came through my later sporting environment looking to be as heavy as I could be. I know that's a bit unusual. So weight gain has been something substantial for me. And there are many sports where that is relevant. There are many sports where it's not relevant. So personally, I typically consume 7 intakes a day. I alternate the meal sizes. I have days within the week where I have a smaller calorie intake. And for me, protein is probably the backbone of my intake. I do respect the potential genetic differences in people and the macronutrients that they relate to, whether it's from the theory of blood typing or whatever theory you ascribe to. And I've got a number of children. They all have different affinities. So I respect the differences in the individual, right through to someone like Bill Pearl, who finished his career as a world champion bodybuilder, eating a vegetarian diet. So I believe that there are many paths to succeed through nutrition. My only expectation is that we seek excellence and honesty and transparency in them.
You know, you've got to be one of the most diplomatic people I've interviewed, Ian, and that's a compliment, believe me, because there's no shortage of judgment and criticism today, to the point where it gets people very irate and uncomfortable, and I just like the way that you handle yourself. That's excellent. I have to commend you on that. Speaking of Bill Pearl, Keys to the Inner Universe, I think I was one of the first guys that bought it. We used to own a gym, a hardcore gym in Vancouver, and it was in the East End, and it was populated with a lot of big brutes during the steroid era. I never took them, but a lot of the equipment was based on Bill Pearl's design. He actually came up and did a seminar for us. And like yourself, I read a lot of those books, you know, Iron Man, and we inherited hundreds of some of these old magazines that went back into the 40s. And it was quite something to read them and to try and interpret and understand them. Now, you mentioned something about commercialism, and I heard you speaking to this in one of your YouTube videos. And so could you comment on the influence of commercialism in the world of fitness, exercise, and athletic training?
So I'm going to share my perspective, and I'm very clear with this. And I think people would be benefited greatly if they considered and reflect on this point. I believe that the majority of what people do is because of a commercial trend. Trends in training don't come out of optimal human outcomes. They come out of commercial influences. And the commercial influences occur at the research level, which taints research, and it occurs at the lay level in terms of lay articles, lay publications. So the reason why everybody is running around doing, they've hijacked the word functional training, in my opinion, is because there are companies that have moved their business model to selling that sort of equipment and drive the education in that regard. That there is very few breakthroughs or penetrations of this defense. And I'll give you an example. One of the reasons that stretching, in my opinion, has not been accepted is because commercial influencers haven't worked out how to commercially benefit from it. Now, when they start designing machines and have a range of machines, the world will be told it'll be okay to do. But until then, there will be no support of that, because if I go out there and I stretch on the grass or the ground or even buy a mat, I'm not selling a lot of equipment. So that is an example. There are many reasons or many factors, I believe, that control how we think and why we think. And I know personally, because when I've released some of my concepts, I've suffered, let me say, some backlash for doing so, because the people who seek to control the way others think don't do or endorse what I teach. And I don't teach to be controversial. I teach what I've been doing for something. In fact, I don't teach anything until I've been doing it for over a decade. So I'm teaching stuff that I believe is well-researched and in the interests of the masses. But I've seen such a backlash to it. So not only do we have commercial influences controlling the way people think, we also have what I call, the guru situation, where if I position myself as a guru and someone else comes up with a different idea that might undermine my guru status, I better shoot that down real quick. So what people do in their exercise is so shaped by inappropriate influences and so inappropriate for their body that I just want, hopefully, that they'll look in the mirror at some stage in their life and say, listen, I've got to stop doing what's suitable to other people. I've got to start doing what I want to do. And I just don't understand how, if we got everybody in our suburb, you know, wherever you live in the world, and 20 families took their motor vehicle down to the local garage and had their car service, would the mechanic do the same service on all 20 cars? And the answer is no. But for some reason, we're all happy to do the same rubbish. Like if we go to an exercise class, we're all doing the same thing. Like the body is a lot more valuable than your motor car. We can replace the parts on your motor car. We haven't really learned how to replace the parts on your body. So people are paying a massive price. And I'm hoping that the veil will be lifted at some point. It might not be in my lifetime, but I'm hoping the veil will be lifted so people learn how to think for themselves and say, is this the best thing for me? Should I be doing walking lunges in my warm-up? There's so many ways that we can say, listen, just ask the question, is this best for me? I'm not interested whether it's effective. I can hit my head with a hammer. It could be effective, but is it the best thing for me? So the question, is this the best thing for me, is not being asked. And I understand the power of commerce and the influence it has on trends, but hopefully one day, and as we enter into the, you know, the age of Aquarius, that there's the promise from the spiritualists that we're going to start seeing a greater enlightening. And I certainly hope so, because I don't want my children and the people I care for, which is, you know, obviously only the people I can influence and touch, to pay the price that others are paying for choosing not to think.
Choosing not to think. Yeah, excellent. Do you get the TV show over there called Seinfeld?
I didn't grow up with TV, so I missed a lot of that, but Seinfeld's a relatively new thing. I'm familiar with Seinfeld. I can't say I've watched a lot of it. It was in other countries, yes.
Okay, one of the key players is George. And on one episode, George, who's a complete failure and who does everything wrong, no matter what he does, he ends up as a disaster no matter what he decides to do. So Jerry suggests that he start doing the opposite. So the episode is called The Opposite. And so George starts doing exactly the opposite of what he would normally do, which also ties in as a parallel to what the masses do, to what convention is saying to do. So from this, I came up with the Costanza principle, which is do the opposite of convention when it comes to health and fitness and nutrition and life. Just do the opposite. And I have yet to really find an exception to the rule where it doesn't create an outcome of positive health and wellness. Now, let's get to your site, Ian, because there's a lot there that people can get to. Tell us what's on your site, what we will find when we get there, and what the address is, please.
Okay, so from the outset, I want to stress that I'm not a marketer. If you graded me on marketing, I'd get an F. It's not my strength, it's not my passion. So don't judge us on the appearance of the site. www.kingsports.net. So King Sports with an S on the end, .net. And my encouragement would be that if you are a professional, if you service other people, either as a physical preparation coach or an allied profession, I'd strongly encourage you to engage in our coach education program. We have 7 levels. The first 2 are delivered electronically, accessible globally. And you know, the information that we include in there is just massive. It's far in excess of even what we've published to date. So if you're a professional, I encourage you to look into our coach education program. If you're an end user, you've got the Get Buff range there. And if you're an athlete, you'll find some excellent resources there. And I understand that simply obtaining resources is just the start, because there are many other challenges for the athlete, as there are for the professional, which is going against the grain and doing things that others do. And as you said about doing the opposite, and my approach is that if I'm doing what everyone else is doing, I'm very concerned. So it's not an intent to stay ahead, but it's reality that, you know, there are masses that will be conformity. And, you know, it was a Rollo May quoted by Earl Nightingale in 1952 or whatever in The Stranger's Secret audio, where he said the opposite of courage is not cowardice, it's conformity. So I have an empathy for the athletes in the pressure that they experience to conform, but that also applies to everybody. You know, if you go down the gym and you want to just do a bit of get buff training, and some well-meaning person will tell you can't do that because nobody does that. So yeah, I just give you that little additional encouragement to have the courage not to conform, over and above whatever resources you find appropriate from our website.
I can't believe you mentioned Earl Nightingale. I discovered him as just a young buck. I think I was 18. And so For 1,000 days in a row, I listened to that audio piece on my cassette tape in the morning when I was shaving and had it sealed into my brain. And, of course, that led me to many, many other greats. You know, you mentioned Jim Rohn, and there's just so many people out there that we can reach out to, that we can service ourselves in a very unique and intimate way and get that wonderful information. And you're certainly one of them. Love your stuff. Love your principles. Love your ideals. And you're the kind of man that we need out there, Ian, to act as a role model and set everybody straight. It's just outstanding. So our time is gone. I really want to thank you very much for taking the time to contribute and give us some insight. And everyone out there on SNU who's listening, our students, our grads, our members worldwide, get to Ian's site, check out kingssports.net, and have a look at his products and services. Ian, we like to end the interview with a final parting comment from our guest. So I'm going to ask you, what is the underlying driving force behind your passion, and you've got a lot of it, to educate and teach your methods to your students?
I think one of the things that drives me is the desire to find the best solutions. And all we're doing is finding solutions to problems. But over and above that, I never entered the profession with the intent to really establish a career or even to create an income. It was purely a personal desire to answer a question. And I had no idea what I was doing when I entered university at 1980 and started coaching. And I had no idea where it was going to go. So for me, it's about working with your gifts. And obviously, I've got a gift for helping people in the physical training. But more importantly, that having a purpose. And working for money for me is not a purpose. It's soul destroying. I certainly get well remunerated for my contribution, but it's not the reason I set out, and it's not the reason I work. So I believe that find your gifts and work for a purpose, and everything else will fall into place. So for me, it is a passion. I treat everybody as if they were my children, and I've helped a lot of people, but after about 20 or so years, I realized I'd help a lot more people if I shared it more globally. So that's what drives us, the desire for excellence. And unfortunately, Corey, it hasn't gone away. You know, the challenge of helping people understand that you're not doing the best for yourself. Let's find a way to do the best thing for yourself. That challenge hasn't gotten easier. And I really thought that once I started sharing my methods in the late 90s, that I'd see a change and an improvement in the world. But it hasn't been the case. And I feel like I'm coming back in and saying, listen, you might have missed the message. Let's go again with this. So we're driven by a desire to leave the world a better place than what I edited it to, and I appreciate those who have contributed to where I am today, and I'm confident that what I've done has served thousands and thousands around the world to date and will continue to do so in my lifetime. And I appreciate this opportunity, Corey, to share with yourself and your listeners.
Ian King is a man with integrity. He has a vision, tremendous passion, and an excellent skill set. He's a teacher and a coach, and he's helping coach athletes and coaches around the world. King Sports International is available online. Get there, get information. Ian, we thank you very much for your contribution on this interview.
Thank you, Corey. Appreciate it, and trust it. It was valuable for everyone listening.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Representing lifestyle, new way of life. Listen, it's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.